started. We have a couple of items on our agenda for this evening, first up is the annual process we go through for appointments to various committees. Council members should have seen this now a couple of times. By way of explanation, the structure changed a little bit from what you've seen in years gone by. Virtually all of the groups are still listed, but based on questions that came up last year as far as when must I recuse, when not, based on a board appointment, I worked with the city attorney, and we actually segmented this into three different groups. And the main page are those where we're mandated to appoint someone for a variety of reasons, either a state law or a contractual obligation or some policy that the council has established. So I'm suggesting that we at least must appoint individuals to those positions. The second group are those that meet the test where they receive significant funding from the city and or operate on in a city facility. So if we think of the RCVB is probably the most obvious. They receive nearly $1 million of funding via the city, and they also operate in a city-owned facility. And I'm looking at the city attorney, so if I say anything wrong, he'll correct me.
I've got the resolution right in front of me.
So if you serve on one of those groups, we viewed that as voluntary, but if you serve, you would still be able to vote should any action item come before the full council. The third group are those where you could still voluntarily choose to participate, but if a board item came before the council, you should not most likely participate in voting at the council level. What I'm suggesting is that we would at least appoint people to the first group, which is what we're required to do, and if individuals voluntarily choose to sit in group two or three, so be it, but we wouldn't necessarily make an explicit appointment. That's kind of the background to how we got to this new format. The other thing I was going to mention is that I left all of the suggested appointments exactly as they were for 2017. In talking with some administrative staff, I'm told that there have been other years gone by where they did that. They just left the appointments stand pat from one year to the next. It's not required that we mix everything up. I think what I've tried to do is rotate people just to give people a sense of broaden our experiences, but also with some eye toward individual preferences. If arts is your thing versus RPU board or whatever, I tried to honor that. So knowing that we were changing the structure significantly, I just, in my first draft, suggested leaving all of the appointments as they were in 2017. This is very much a draft. Those were the background comments for how we got to where we are. And now I would entertain some discussion. We'll take formal action on this later this evening. Mr. Campion.
So I think I've been talking quite a bit over the last year about how we manage the external agency oversight. So I'm glad that we'll finally set that up. I'm just wondering, do we need to be clear on this document? Like we had talked earlier about having it be a standing committee. So people, any council member can come in. It's not necessarily just two council members who will be sitting there. The operations of that committee in particular being public, I think, was pretty important.
Are you talking about the oversight, the new oversight
committee? Yeah, the outside agency oversight committee, because I think, again, as we go through this, what I'd like to see is an opportunity for any council member to get involved and get that information. I think during the interview, but certainly during some of our processes as a council at the retreat, we talked a lot about equal access to some of the information. One of my concerns is, when those groups have a problem, it becomes public really quickly. So having a way for council members to be able to get engaged and to stay abreast of what's happening with those different external organizations to me is critical.
So a question for the city attorney, whether there is a quorum of council members or not, are any of these groups open to the public?
Well, it's a
broad brush you just painted with. You're talking about a board that's created by ordinance or resolution, which the policy oversight, or not the policy, what are we calling it?
Well, I have the name right.
Agency oversight.
The OAO.
That will be...
No, don't do that.
OAO.
OAO. No, I'm just sorry, I couldn't resist.
Will be created by, at least by resolution. That makes it subject to the open meetings and open records law because it's a committee created as a standing committee by the council.
So we can create it. We're going to do what we want. I guess my mere suggestion, having not proceeded to do it yet, would be to establish it as a standing committee. You guys, then anyone that wants to be at those meetings can come and go, is my understanding?
I think it's listed under that category.
Standing committee. Perfect. All right. Problem solved.
Okay. Mr. Ruskin?
Yeah, didn't see the head.
I would think that any of our groups would be open to meeting with any of the council members at any time also. So rather than having a lot of cooks in the kitchen, I'd rather everything kind of was shared with the representatives. But yet, I'm sure any of these groups would be happy to meet with any council member that would come up and say, hey, do you have an hour to go through some things with you? So that would seem like an easy way to work through that.
I want to take exception and explain why that last comment is something that we can't do. There is a difference between being active in a meeting that has a quorum or less than a quorum of city council members and then subsequently taking information from the quorum and expanding that quorum in private. That's something that we should not be doing, and that's why I like the idea of let's identify who's on these, who wants to be on these committees ahead of time and just have them on there. That doesn't change that. But when we start having private conversations between these committees and additional council members, that strikes me as an not necessarily a deliberate, but a pretty clear violation of the open meeting statute.
Ms. Johnson?
I'm confused. You were suggesting that the other, I'm going to throw out the civic theater, because you were suggesting that if a council member wanted to have a conversation, they could have a conversation with the civic theater, but yeah, not the other council members. Mm-hmm. That was my understanding.
So the
I'm lost.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the standing committees, in particular, the committees that are comprised, I'm interested mostly right now at this part of the discussion, the committees that are comprised entirely of council members. That's the the committee of the whole, which we don't even list, but obviously we're all on the committee of the whole. It also includes the personnel advisory committee. And now it will, the third one in this particular category will include the oversight of the outside agencies, that group. And what I'm saying is that these are public bodies consisting of council members. There is no, any limitation we put on the number of members is entirely arbitrary, and it doesn't change that these are public bodies with public meetings. So what I was suggesting for those ones and the couple other that we'll talk about later that I want to add is that just any council member that wishes to be on there, let's put them on those ones.
But you mean define them as being a member, not just leave the membership open to who chooses to participate in the meetings?
Well, I think that just for practical purposes, we can update it at any time. But I just say if someone wants to be on these committees at the beginning of the year, and let's put their name on the list and make sure they get the communications.
Yeah, I want to make sure we have a quorum to do the work of the committees. That's
right.
The important
yep.
part. So I can understand assigning some people to be responsible. If other people want to come and participate, I think they should be able to do
well,
so.
Well, and that's just it. That's why it's voluntary. If you want to be on these lists, there's no need to necessarily designate. I've already stated that I'm interested in sitting in with the Personnel Advisory Committee and being part of that one, for example. And, there's nothing wrong with the three folks that are already on there. It's just there's no hardship in adding any other council member who's interested.
So the process is that we, for this group one, we nominate and then the council approves later this evening.
Yeah.
So if I understand the comment correctly, I'll pick one, the Personnel Advisory Committee. You would suggest that any council member could
correct.
Sit in on that and participate on that committee?
Correct.
In other words, should all the council members be listed there?
If they choose to be. That's my point. And that's only for the ones that are comprised entirely of council members.
Mr. Hickey?
So you'd mentioned this is a draft. So, I think what you're saying is you want to be on the Personnel Advisory Committee.
Well,
fine, right?
No, and I don't have, it's what I'm saying is anyone who wants to be on the Personnel Advisory Committee.
I don't think anybody else does. Besides you and the people that are on there already.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's a good one on this. That's a
sure.
good point on this one. I was just saying the other ones that are, the other bodies that are comprised entirely of council members, same thing. If
right.
somebody wants to be on it, three is an arbitrary number in this particular case. I totally get on the other ones why a lot of times there's ordinances that designate the number of people
mm-hmm.
that are on there, but in this particular one, there's three is entirely arbitrary.
So, Mr. Ruskin.
Gary, I know maybe you can help us with this, and I don't see Linda here, but I know a lot of times on the Personnel Advisory Committee, some of the stuff that she sends out, she doesn't want it to be public record. So if we have four, would that create the opportunity for it to be public record, or is it just public record?
The Personnel Advisory Committee is already subject to the open meetings, open records law,
okay.
but there's an exception for personnel data, which is private by state law. So whether you have one or all seven council members, that doesn't change.
Okay, so would she send out the documents that are pertaining to the meeting to all the council members, or?
If you list all the council members as members of the committee, yes, just like the committee
okay.
of the whole.
All right, so I make sure it wasn't going to follow her up that she's not here.
So on this group, the only one that I hear keep coming up is the Personnel Advisory Committee. So,
well, also the Oversight, which is, I don't think that's on
okay.
here. Oh, the Outside Agency Oversight. Current representative is just, you know, there's 2018 representatives that are listed there.
Right.
Again, anyone can be on that one. Same thing, it's a public body.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've suggested a couple other ones I'd like to see us take as standing committees.
Well, this is a good time to discuss
right.
that.
Yeah, now's the time.
Does it make sense in my mind? I like the idea of having clear people who will be there that are committed to being
right.
there. And
right.
so, is there... We have chairs marked on here. Does it make sense for the outside agency one list everyone, mark the chairpersons, and to have those people be responsible for
it? I don't want to be on that one.
Oh.
just
all right. So right. speak up now. I think if we're in general agreement just to add council members where they would like for those boards, then speak up now and be added. I think that sounds fine to me.
So, with that said, are there any of these that others who aren't named already would like to participate? We'll put the name down.
Well, I'll be on PAC. The other one was I brought up that I wanted to see two more standing committees. One of them might be a little bit premature at this point, but certainly on the affordable housing, we've had substantial discussion about that. And what I'd like to see in 2018 is a standing committee entirely focused around that, so the folks that are interested in that topic can have, you know, monthly updates and interactions with staff in terms of what we're doing towards this item, which we've already designated as one of our top priorities. And that'll, I think, help keep the process moving a little bit smoother than... You know, it was in 2017. Granted, we have a ton of turnover in 2017 as well. The other one is, another one that we've adopted as our as a top community priority is this fiscal sustainability, particularly as it refers to infrastructure. And I think that would be a good standing committee as well. If I had to punt on one of them, I'd say that one perhaps we take up in a couple of months because we're still getting some... direction from staff on how we're going to handle budgetary issues and long-term planning going forward. But I think those, and again, the idea is not to monopolize on the, on being involved in this particular activity. It's more that this is, again, any number of council members can be on there. It's not intended to be busy work. It's intended to keep the process moving on our high priority items, you know, meeting every month or two. To go over what the plans are on the issues. So those are the two that I put out there for additional standing committees.
So this is a question for the city attorney. All of these on this first page, with the exception of the outside agency oversight, are formed by a resolution that was adopted back in 2014. So if we wanted to if you really wanted to add more standing committees to this list, we would have to introduce a... new resolution.
Well, we'll amend 04214 to, for example, PAC right now is three appointments. If you want to make it four, then we'll amend the resolution tonight under other business to make it four appointments. Now, if you want to add additional committees, I would wait until you actually establish those committees. For example, the OAO has yet to be established, as far as I know.
Yep.
So and once yet I'm assigned to it.
Once you establish that committee, then you go back and amend once again this resolution
to add that in. Because we have to do that with the outside anyway, then.
Right. And so it's a work in progress. But for tonight, if you're going to make PAC 4 appointees, we'll need to amend this resolution.
Do we need to specify the number of appointees on these ones?
Well, the resolution itself does, primarily for guidance and history. And given the fact that you're about to have a major change, at least in the city administration or city attorney's office, it might be helpful for my successor to understand just who's on here and how many are on there.
The other thing I would mention is it makes it easier for the staff people to know who they got to contact to get coordinated schedules. So, like, adding a fourth to the PAAC is not a problem, but having an indeterminate number, and then how does the staff figure out when they're going to meet?
I want to specifically say I've been on enough committees that have an indeterminate number of participants, and when you have an indeterminate number, you have no participants. So I think having a set group that's going to drive it is good.
Yeah, and as long as we set that ahead of time, I'm cool with wherever those numbers fall.
So we would be modifying the standing resolution to make the Personnel Advisory Committee 4 appointments?
Yes.
And designate Mr. Wojcik as the additional person?
Yeah, for purposes of the resolution, I'll just make this 4. I don't actually designate individuals in the resolution.
Right. But
on your motion tonight, yes, you'll designate Mr. Wojcik.
Right.
So it's a two-step process.
Under other business, we'll have to initiate the amendment, or is that a policy that we can change?
We'll change it right away.
Okay, perfect.
There's no ordinance.
And then I also have no... In my comments that I submitted, I also pointed out that too often there's back and forth on issues between RPU and the Energy Commission. RPU is quite a big load to carry sometimes, and it would be my preference that somebody else serve on the Energy Commission so that I'm not necessarily on the different sides of the same argument when those boards sometimes see things from a different way. And I've also been on the Energy Commission. I'm the last founding member that's part of that because Mr. Ruska abandoned us a while ago. So I'm more than willing to give that up. And in particular, I want to make Annalise work harder. just from the standpoint that there's right now she's sitting with two board appointments, and one of them doesn't meet as best I can tell, or very seldom meets.
So let's take those one at a time, and we'll take up the Energy Commission. But Mr. Ruska,
well, I was just kind of going through with these changes that would leave Michael on 8 committees. I'd be happy if he has a problem with the Energy Commission and the RPU. I'd be happy to take the RPU position. Yeah. I've only got 3 that I'm on, so that would kind of balance that out too a little bit.
The RPU is probably the one that's most of interest to me, so I'm comfortable sticking with that one.
I would think the Energy Commission RPU having the same representative makes a lot of sense. But
well, I've been there for a while, so I guess
I'm open to whatever the group would like to do. Mr. Hickey, are you raising your hand?
Nope.
I guess that would, the suggestion that I'm hearing is that Ms. Johnson might take Mr. Wojcik's spot on the Energy Commission, but I would ask, if that's... When do they meet?
Yes.
First off.
Second Tuesdays, 4:30 p.m.
The facial expression gave that away.
I, have the opposite schedule of everybody else. I work at night, so... Yeah. What is the city council member's role or responsibility on that committee?
Presence.
That does sum it up. Presence, but a lot of times it's just bringing questions back to staff that arise in the meetings. I'm a little bit uncomfortable on the Energy Commission.
I would just refer you to the manual. Let's go on.
Well, Jane, the other thing is the notion that older windows, if then properly restored, how they perform versus new windows. I mean, I've read a lot of things where people don't ask for that data, and the windows being put in the end, are demonstrated to perform no better,
or
and
worse.
Sometimes worse,
yes.
than the windows that were there.
And that brings me to another one of my books that I brought, and those are the, this book that I have here is a compilation of a variety of publications the National Park Service has developed over many years on best practices for repair, replacement, and maintenance of historic slate roofs is the one I'm looking at, and there's one on windows, and I would highly recommend this. This is available as an individual, as a series of individual reports. They're called preservation briefs. They're available online. You don't necessarily need to have a bound book, but if you wanted to have this in your library for the public to look at, it's something.
But again, as what we have is an ordinance that refers to the Secretary of Interior standards.
Mm-hmm.
And these preservation briefs give guidance to meet the Secretary of Interior
exactly.
standards. So again, it's appropriate for us to reference these as, have
exactly.
you looked at this or doing this?
They're cost effective.
Right.
They're simple, usually. They have been tried and true as far as not creating a negative impact on other historic material. So the window recommendations in there are, you know, they're there if someone says, I need to change my windows. here's an alternative. Here's a way to
look at this
piece. to meet your objectives in a different way. So I would recommend that. Let's go on, and I would again refer you to the manual to be able to read all that detail. Here are reasons to keep your historic windows from the standpoint of preserving the integrity of the building. They serve an aesthetic and historic function in terms of communicating something about the character of your building and the way it was originally designed. However, the old windows on your building may not necessarily be the historic windows that are relating to the original design of the building. That's something to think about. And that's alluded to in that first one. Your old windows there may not be significant. They may just be older windows that don't actually relate to the house and its architectural significance. It may need repair. Look at your preservation brief and determine the appropriate treatment for the window.
Basic maintenance.
Yeah, basic maintenance is usually the
first steps.
Okay. If you must replace, and this is not true of just windows, but everything, if you must replace historic fabric with new, try to make it, don't make it jarringly.
Right.
Don't distract from original elements. Here's your addition question again, and this is back to what we were talking around Mark's question. In a downtown district where there is no room to expand to the side or the back or someplace that is not visible, people may want to go up. What one should try to do is to go back if you go up so it's not highly visible.
Do you ever see ones where they take that facade, go up, but maintain that, and it's been approved? Go back?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not
go, you know, so they just said, well, it used to be a two-story, we're going to make a third, but we're going to make it look just the same, but three stories tall. Would that be a violation?
I know what you're asking. But it's not preferred.
Yeah. Right, you mentioned it wasn't. But it
distract. It changes the original design.
Yeah.
And in the case of IBM, I'm assuming you're thinking. But
no, we didn't add floors. It was always.
You had.
We had buildings that built out.
But you have buildings now that are taller.
was a sloping.
Yeah.
Yeah, the berm kind of keeps the original appearance from the highway.
A bit, yeah.
Which was under the situation, you didn't change the original.
Yeah.
It was a way of trying to mitigate your addition. So anyway. Principles for additions.
And the second one, maintain the ability to perceive the historic character of the main building. Mm-hmm. I think that says it really clearly. Mm-hmm. If an addition occurs.
But that was my point. It's a two-story building. I made it look just the same now, but it's three stories. That's not really acceptable.
That's not maintaining the historic character of the main building as defined.
Just because you moved the whole thing up and kept the architectural flourishes, that's not what we're looking for.
You would want
the original facade and size and height is matters.
Part of its character.
There's a really good preservation brief on that that's got a lot of photographs and examples.
So good. Something to refer to perhaps before your next meeting. That's going to be heard.
Coming from an architect's standpoint, it's pretty hard to say it was a two-story building and it's the same, but now it's three.
I know, right.
Sorry.
I know. Yeah.
No,
I'm just saying someone could say, well, I kept the facade the same, it's just taller.
It just kind of changes not only the character, but it's back to what we talked about at the beginning of this meeting, where you have an addition and you can't tell that it's an addition.
Yeah,
so
you have to be able to
built a lot of. This was a very important person
it's
in town.
Been, yeah, all the three-story houses around here.
This was an important building because it was three stories, and everything else around it is only two.
Right.
It adds a layer of meaning.
It changes the story.
It adds a false sense of history.
Yeah.
This is for preserving historic homes. Is there one on commercial buildings?
There may be, but I would just go to the individual.
The briefs.
Individual briefs. Yeah.
And Gail's searching.
You should be able to find pretty easily.
Well, I think Gail's thinking we could send something
more
out.
More detail about,
right?
About how to add a sensitive addition or historically appropriate addition. Trying to see what the third one is because, well, they're all cool. They are all acceptable. So you've got that separate module that doesn't dwarf the original one that's connected with a throughway, a small
module
that's set back from the front and it's probably not visible from the side, from the street.
The roof line is similar.
But it's similar, but yet it's different.
Yeah.
It doesn't distract, but it's easy to tell if you're looking which is which. And they're showing you a variety of different, or some different shapes and different forms and how to treat them. L-shaped building.
Sure.
Small passage. Two-story carriage house. Again, this is in the manual. Much easier to study it there.
Yeah.
So let's go on. This is about in a historic district, keeping the same scale, keeping a similar style, but yet not trying to reconstruct exactly a building that could be mistaken for an old one. New buildings express their true age. Different ordinance, some ordinances actually treat this and have design guidelines that govern this.
Kind of follow the flavor of the
survey. We can go on.
It's a preservation brief 14. New exterior additions to historic buildings, preservation concerns.
Brent, can you send that out to the HPC with or include that with the packet?
Sure.
Brief 14.
I'll
You'll send it to him and then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gail.
Send it to me, Gail. It'll be great.
Okay.
Okay. And this is kind of words of encouragement from. Let's go on.
That's pretty sure.
Yeah, these are things. things that, on HPC might collaborate with community members on. They're all things that are social trends that are active right now that have to do with historic resources and might involve an HPC. Let's go on. And it's telling you that you're not always going to win. You may not be happy all the time. Try to keep a long view. Let's go on. And again, outreach with the community, other community institutions, and members of general public. And, education is key. People will do better if they know what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do, and why and how. So let's go on. It's the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. and the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota would be happy to help you if you have issues or questions or wanted a speaker or any such thing. Heritage Preservation Department is the SHPO, Minnesota Historical Society. You know about that. National Alliance of Preservation Commissions is, you probably know about. It's a national organization. They have a membership, and they publish a journal, and I think they have a blog, a presence where HPCs help each other. That might be something to look at.
Which we haven't talked about yet.
I think it's a reasonable cost. I the old committee, pre-ordinance committee, that was looking at joining that, and did something else instead. Anyway, let's go on. There you go.
Jane, while you're on that, can you just give a brief overview of the State Preservation Conference that occurs each year? Because that's not something that this group in its current iteration has participated in. Jeff Allman, past chair, would go to the National Preservation Conference. What's interesting about the state conference is it's in the state.
Mm-hmm.
More members can attend, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could just give it's usually in August?
It's in September.
September.
Early September, probably the second week of September. And it's organized by the MHS, Minnesota Historical Society, nominally with the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota as well. They used to be 50-50. Now Pam is doing a little less. Pam handles the Main Street, but anyway, it's a very brief conference. It's in the state. There are all kinds of interesting educational programs that are optional. You can choose to attend the full 2.5-day program, or attend just a portion of it. The fee is proportionate to the amount of time you want to spend there. You can do a daily rate. You can do the whole thing. It's very affordable. I think it's $90 to attend the entire conference. I'm trying to think what else. Typically, there's an opening reception that has a keynote speaker. And then there's a two-day program that concludes on the second day with a tour, or a choice of several tours that are bus tours.
Yeah, based on the location that it's at.
Based on the location, yeah. And the HPCs in the location are usually very active and do programming as well, talking about their challenges as HPCs, things that they have done over the past year, things like that might be showcased. So I think for an HPC member, it would be especially valuable. It talks about the sessions are highly varied. They can have design guidelines,
awesome.
People from Illinois coming to talk.
That's awesome.
Or the people from the Main Street that are talking about the various things. The Main Street program talking about the economic initiatives that they implemented and how it's worked for them. Pam talking about their educational programming and what they have found, and, you know, it could be, it changes so much from year to year. But I've been going for the last 15 years or so. Maybe not to every single one, but the ones that are in southern Minnesota, I typically always go to. found them very worthwhile and very enjoyable. Met a lot of people, very wonderful networking opportunities. They feed you.
Well, and it's a very unlike the national one, it's a very reasonable cost.
Exactly.
That more broadly, you know, could involve commission members broadly, which I think is appealing.
I know John Harford went when it was in Lanesboro.
That's because his son is a preservation architect, but okay.
Anyway, the only other person from Rochester besides my partner and myself.
Yeah. And this year it was in Albert Lea?
This year it was in Albert Lea, yeah.
And you mentioned, one of the things you mentioned in this presentation is the people who came from Virginia with alternative materials. That was at one of the state
exactly.
conferences.
They do a good job, and if there are certain questions that you have that you'd like to see a presentation about, I think Michael Krupp is one of the organizers.
Yeah.
I would contact him and say, could we have something on that? And he's always looking for topics, so he'd be pretty receptive. So I think this is it. Let's go on. Thank you for your service. All right. Well, thank you all for having me here.
Great helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I commend you all for making this effort. It's huge responsibility and not always fun, but is very, very helpful for our community, I think. Very necessary in this time of growth.
Any questions? Amen. Any questions?
Just an outside question. Has anybody heard anything on the site? The Bierman House?
Oh, funny you should ask.
Do people know what the Bierman House is?
It doesn't ring a bell.
So the gatehouse is a red brick house. Teresa is very familiar with it. Teresa's firm and our firm collaborated on a historic structures report a year ago. Mm-hmm. It is owned by Olmsted County. It's at the base of the driveway.
Oh.
It's right at the
building there.
Fascinating. What would you call it? I say Italianate, but
it's
It's not
Italian,
really.
But
yeah.
It's,
is it on the list at all?
It's a German.
It's not in the city.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's the one we talked about. That was out. Okay.
What did you say?
So what? There's sort of a Romanesque tower that we think is an exterior addition.
So what's the latest?
Well, the county had rented it to Olmsted County Historical Society for 20 years for $10.
Yep.
And Historical Society, I brought this all for you guys. Historical Society had.
Brent, did you get those books written down?
Used it as an executive director's residence. For a number of years, served very well.
Those are the last ones. They didn't have those yet. We were slow. It was backed up at my
house. They turned off the heat, forgot to turn off the water. So a lot of damage was done. This was all in draft. No one was told. And now their lease is up, and county has been used for it because they had bought it as a potential interpretive center for it.
And they're taking bids.
They've issued an RFP and they are taking bids and they're walking for the house. There were a number of people who were looking at it.
So when's the deadline for the
RFP? Deadline has been changed as of today till February 9th.
Okay.
And
why? Do you know?
Because my partner and I requested it.
Okay.
And no one objected. But we're working with someone who has offered to.
No one in the county objected.
No one who is currently registered on the RFP site to receive the RFP has found it disadvantageous. So they've just.
It was extended. Okay.
Because we are working with a private donor who's interested in doing a rehab and would give it to. Park department.
Wow.
Nice. And which is very exciting. And this would have to be approved by the park board, and there's no time to get this.
So that's why you needed. You had a valid reason for needing the time.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything confidential about that, but I told you.
Mark, thank you.
Is there a meeting?
What?
Brent, can we stop the recording?
Then the pileated red woodpecker has returned to the park.